Last time we talked about the topic of comparative advantage. If we go back to the very beginnings of that concept with David Ricardo, economists have always found it easier to talk about it using a numerical example. So I'm going to go through a few numerical examples in this lecture. The first example is one that will work if you're a baseball fan, may not work as well if you're not. But there are two players on the Yankees, Derek Jeter and Jeremy Giambi. And Jeter is a tremendous all-around athlete and defensive player, and Giambi is more of a hitter who doesn't play very good defense. So you have a choice between playing one of them at first base and one of them at shortstop. And if you look at the first column, errors at first base, Jeter would, in a course of a season, might make only two errors if he were the first baseman. I'm just being hypothetical here. Giambi might make 20 errors. If you put them at shortstop for an entire season, Jeter might make 15 errors, Giambi might make 120 errors. So where should you play them? Well, if Jeter plays shortstop and Giambi plays first base, then you'll have Giambi's 20 errors at first base plus Jeter's 15 errors at shortstop, and you'll have a total of 35 errors. Again, this is all hypothetical. Total errors if Jeter plays first base and Giambi plays shortstop would be the 2 plus 120 or 122. So it's better, you'll have fewer errors if you put Jeter at shortstop. That's kind of a numerical way of illustrating what I think any baseball manager would understand intuitively without the numbers, which is that your better defensive athlete should play shortstop and the weaker defensive athlete should play first base. So what we say in terms of comparative advantage is that Jeter has a comparative advantage at playing shortstop. By the same token, Giambi has a comparative advantage at playing first base. That's comparative advantage is always a symmetric term. If one person's better at doing something, then the other person is better at doing something else. Not maybe absolutely better, but the best arrangement is to have one person doing one thing, the other person doing the other thing, and in this case, you would say that, again, that Giambi's comparative advantage is playing first base. Okay, let me move on then to the next example, which is this household example. Let's say you have a couple of roommates, John and Fred, and what we measure is the time it takes for them to fold 10 shirts or to roll 10 pairs of socks. It turns out Fred is better, can do both tasks faster than John. It takes John 10 minutes to fold 10 shirts. Fred can do it in 4 minutes. It takes John 5 minutes to roll 10 pairs of socks, and Fred can do it in 4 minutes. So when the laundry's done, Fred could do either task more quickly. We say that Fred has an absolute advantage in both shirts and socks. That the fact that he's more efficient at both folding shirts and rolling socks after the laundry's done says that Fred has an absolute advantage in each one. But that's not true for comparative advantage. Okay, who should fold the shirts and who should fold the socks? Well, obviously, if it takes John sort of twice as long to do shirts as socks, and if Fred can do them in equal time, you'd be better off having John do the socks and Fred do the shirts. And that indicates comparative advantage. Fred has a comparative advantage in doing shirts, but in terms of socks, John has a comparative advantage. Even though it takes John longer to roll the socks than it takes Fred, John's comparative advantage is in doing socks. That is, you're better off having John work on the socks and let Fred do the thing that he's even more efficient at relative to John, which is to fold shirts. So how would this work out numerically, for example? If John folds, let's say you have 40 pairs of socks. If John folds them, what is the opportunity cost in terms of shirts? That is, how many shirts will he not be able to fold if he folds socks. So if he does 40 pairs of socks, and that means four sets of 10 pairs, so he takes him 5 minutes to do 10, so to do 40, it would take him 20 minutes. So if John folds 40 pairs of socks, that will take him 20 minutes. That means he could have folded 20 shirts, because that's how many shirts he can fold. So the opportunity cost for John for folding 40 pairs of socks is 20 shirts. For Fred, if he folds 40 pairs of socks, since he can fold 10 pairs in 4 minutes, it will take him 16 minutes to fold the socks. In those same 16 minutes, he could have folded 40 shirts. And you can just see that since he takes the same amount of time to do 10 pairs of socks and 10 shirts, obviously if Fred folds 40 pairs of socks, it's obvious since he can do the same amount of shirts that his opportunity cost is 40 shirts. Whereas for John, the opportunity cost, since he only folds half as many shirts in the same amount of time as he does socks, if for John, the opportunity cost of folding 40 socks, pairs of socks is 20 shirts. So since there's a smaller opportunity cost to John of folding socks, John's comparative advantage is folding socks. That is, whatever is the smaller opportunity cost is what you should do. So the opportunity cost to John of folding socks, the amount of shirts he has to give up is smaller, so he should specialize in socks, and Fred should specialize in shirts. And you could turn this, so that's demonstrating that John has a comparative advantage in socks. You can turn this around and find the symmetry to see that Fred has a comparative advantage in shirts. You could say, well, let's suppose you had 40 shirts to fold, and you can ask, what would Fred's opportunity cost in terms of socks be versus what John's opportunity cost in socks would be, and it will turn out that John's opportunity cost in socks would be twice as much as Fred's opportunity cost. That is, if you think in terms of folding shirts and you say the opportunity cost is how many socks you give up folding, the opportunity cost is twice as high for John as for Fred. So that says that it is not a good idea for John to fold shirts. It's a good idea for Fred to fold shirts. So you get the exact same overall outcome by looking at it either way. The bottom line is that Fred should do shirts and John should do socks. If John does shirts, he would give up twice as much in terms of socks he could have folded as Fred does. Or looking at it in terms of socks, if Fred does socks, he'll give up twice as much in terms of shirts as Fred, as, or if Fred does socks, he'll give up twice as many shirts as John would. So that's the way we talk about it in terms of opportunity cost. I think that rather than get lost in all the terminology, I think it's easier just to look at the numbers and see that Fred should specialize in shirts because he can do an equal number of shirts and socks, whereas John is really slow at especially slow at doing shirts, so that John should specialize in socks. Next, we look at David Ricardo's classic example of cloth and wine being produced in England and Portugal. And Ricardo specified, you know, just guessed what the amount of labor that might be required to produce one unit of cloth and one unit of wine in each of those two countries. So you can think of this as, you know, a bottle of wine and a shirt and the amount of labor in, you know, 1 hour or whatever. So you see, so the assumption is that England requires 100 units of labor to do cloth, to get one unit of cloth, and 120 20 units of labor to get 1 unit of wine. Portugal, the figures are 90 units of labor to get 1 unit of cloth and 80 units of labor to get 1 unit of wine. So in terms of absolute advantage, Portugal has the advantage in producing cloth. That is, it takes Portugal less labor to produce cloth, and it also has the absolute advantage in wine. It takes less labor to produce wine. However, England requires relatively less labor to produce cloth, and so it has a comparative advantage in producing cloth. That is, the difference, or the ratio of the amount of labor required to produce wine in England compared to Portugal is much higher than the ratio in cloth. You can see that England is almost as productive as Portugal in cloth, but England is way less productive in wine. It requires a lot more labor in England to produce wine than it does in Portugal. So because of that, the comparative advantage England has is in cloth. The comparative advantage that Portugal has is in wine. Next, I move on to something that I call a simpler Ricardo type example. And this is one where we take the rest of the world, we take the rest of the world's production capability is given, and we just look at our country. So our country is going to be England, and England's going to be dealing with a world market in which one shirt can be exchanged for one bottle of wine. And there's a lot of production out there in the world, and it doesn't really matter what we produce, whether we choose to produce wine or shirts or any combination of the two. We're such a small part of the world that regardless of how we end up producing things, one shirt can be exchanged for one bottle of wine, because that's the way the rest of the production possibilities lay out in the rest of the world. So there's that exchange rate. Now suppose we take from Ricardo, we say that it takes 100 hours to produce a shirt, or 100 workers an hour to produce a shirt, and 120 workers an hour to produce a bottle of wine. And suppose that as consumers, the people of England want to spend half of their income on shirts and half of their income on wine. Suppose we have 12,000 workers, and we start out in a situation without trade, so we have to produce everything ourselves. So if we're going to put half of our income in shirts and half in wine, that means we would want to put half of our workers in shirts and half of our workers in wine. So that would mean 6,000 workers in shirts and 6,000 in wine. And the shirt production, since it takes 100 hours to produce a shirt, if we have 6,000 workers divided by 100, we would get 60 shirts per hour. Similarly, wine production, since it takes 120 workers and we're putting 6,000 in wine production, we would get 50 bottles of wine per hour. So with trade, So without trade, we would have 60 shirts and 50 bottles of wine. Now with trade, we would want to specialize. Since we can exchange one shirt for one bottle of wine, there's no reason for us to produce any wine at home. We'll just produce all shirts. That's our comparative advantage. It's the same comparative advantage that I showed before. So if we work with our comparative advantage, we put all 12,000 of our workers in shirts. With all 12,000 workers in the shirt industry, and remember it takes 100 workers to produce one shirt, that means we're producing 120 shirts an hour. Now we can trade then, because we want to spend half of our income on wine, we trade half of our shirts on the world market for wine. But in the world market, one shirt can exchange for one bottle of wine. So we get So now, with the same workers, we can consume 60 shirts, but 60 bottles of wine. We've gained 10 bottles of wine from being able to trade and specialize. That is, before trade, we split our workers up and had 60 shirts and 50 bottles of wine. Now, with trade, we put all of our workers in the shirt industry, where we have a comparative advantage, and we get to consume 60 shirts and 60 bottles of wine. So that's, again, a numerical illustration of using comparative advantage in trade to increase what we can consume with the same total amount of work effort. So what are the main principles we're trying to learn about trade from these kinds of numerical examples? The first principle is that we can always consume more with trade than without trade. That is, we make our consumers better off, and on average, the country is better off with trade, because with comparative advantage, we're able to use our resources more efficiently and take advantage of the world market. The second principle is that the opportunity cost is higher in the pre-trade domestic market than in the pre-trade world market. That is, before trade, before we could trade, in order to get 50 bottles of wine, we had to give up 60 shirts. That is, we had to take half of our workers out of shirts, and where we could have produced 60 of them, and put them into wine where we only got 50 bottles of wine. But with the world market, the opportunity cost was lower. Instead of giving up 60 shirts and getting 50 bottles of wine, in the world market we could give up 60 shirts and get 60 bottles of wine. So the opportunity cost was not as high. We did not have to give up as many shirts in the world market to get a bottle of wine as we did in our home market. And the final point to keep in mind is that people in the wine industry in England probably would not be happy with free trade, because they're going to be thrown out of work, or temporarily thrown out. They're going to have to switch over to the clothing industry, and that's painful for them. So what you would see in the real world if you went from no trade to free trade is that people in the wine industry would start to complain about other countries doing unfair trade or dumping their wine and so on. So you would see people in the wine industry complaining all the way as we opened up the economy to trade, until eventually people in this extreme example would have all left the wine industry and moved into the shirt industry, which is our comparative advantage. So the point of today's lecture was to show how the numerical examples can help illustrate and clarify comparative advantage. And if you didn't see that the first time we went through this, then I would suggest you go back, rewind, and play it again to make sure that you understand how the numerical examples work, because that's the point of this lecture. Thanks.